Welcome, Derek, or should I say Sax Spy. Welcome to this, whatever it is, podcast, show, conversations that are recorded. Welcome.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff. I'm glad to be here. This will be a lot of fun.
I hope so. So we were just having some really fun technical difficulties as those things seem to pop up right when you need them to work. Anyway, I'm glad we finally got things working, but it was appropriate because I think we might want to be talking today about if gear matters. You know, you do a lot of work with saxophones and accessories for saxophones, mouthpieces, ligatures, end plugs, the works. So I think today we will touch on whether or not gear matters. And I'd love to hear your opinion on that. But before we get into any of those deep philosophical conversations, why don't you give me the rundown of where Sax Spy started? And I'd love to know where the name came from, but also just sort of the nuts and bolts of the shop and everything else.
Sure. So Sax Spy all started as a way to document my search for the perfect saxophone. And it was basically three years ago. I just started an Instagram. I didn't know what to name it, and Sax and Spy started with an S, so that's where that came from. And I figured, you know, I'm looking for saxophones, it kind of works. Originally, I was the Sax Spy, but a couple marketers told me to switch it up and, you know, get rid of that "the."
That's huge.
Yeah. I mean, the story they told me was that Facebook used to be the Facebook, and you know, imagine that today.
I remember that.
But anyway, yeah, so I was just taking pictures, trying out school horns and, you know, friends' horns and, you know, players around. And I ended up leaning towards the Mark VI, but people started following me as I was on that journey. And I was learning about all those different things. So that's kind of where it came from.
And have you found the perfect saxophone?
I'm pretty close. You never know. I mean, there's always, the grass is always greener, but.
I suppose so. Now, do you think the perfect saxophone is a subjective thing or an objective thing?
I think there's elements of both. And so I guess in a way I probably do have the perfect saxophone because it meets everything that I meets all the needs that I have for it. But objectively, I mean, your gear needs to work. And so the perfect saxophone would allow you to be able to, you know, play well, play in tune, have a good sound, that kind of thing.
And you do a lot of work with vintage horns, right?
Yeah. I mean, mostly just discovering them. I'm not really in the repair business, but the Cannibal factory is just down the street from my house, and the techs live a street away in my neighborhood. And so, you know, we're always hanging out and talking shop and trying to learn stuff that way.
Because I was thinking when you were saying the saxophone needs to work for it to be, you know, quote unquote, the perfect saxophone. You know, those vintage horns, I can speak from experience, they tend to fall apart a lot more frequently than the newer horns. Do you find that as well?
I mean, there's some elements to that. They are just older. And so if they've had a lot more wear, you know, over time, then certainly they're going to need more adjustments. Let me show you, for example. So this right here is basically mint Mark VII. And it's got really tight keys, really tight springs, and it feels like a modern saxophone in that regard.
Mm-hmm. And for everybody that's not viewing the video here, that was a beautiful looking horn. Just so you all know.
Just imagine a shimmer of gold and a.
Was that a relacquered horn or?
No, this one's original. This was a closet horn.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah, but anyway, yeah. So, I mean, just over years, if the keys aren't oiled correctly, you know, you're going to wear down the places that the metal touches. And that's going to, you know, if you don't get them key fit, then that's going to shift a lot. So, and depending if someone's taking care of the instrument or if they've dropped it or if it's gone, you know, the banana bend, then that is going to factor in as well. Lots of things to consider when you're buying vintage. It's a little bit harder, but it's rewarding.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you certainly get a unique, a unique character out of the instrument when it's a little bit older and not right off the factory line. But I mean, my soprano is one of those Yamaha, the newer Yamaha models. And I don't play it that often anymore, but when I was playing it, I don't think I ever got it repaired. It was just like, it was rock solid. And I remember my, you know, my Mark VI when I was, you know, playing on that all the time too. I was taken into the shop maybe at least once a year. So
yeah, but, you know. Absolutely. Yeah. Same thing with me. I have one of the new Cannibal Vintage Brutes. I've had it for maybe 10 years or so. It's kind of it's a great horn. I didn't really have to get anything done on it for, yeah, the first 10 years, like maybe a pad or two here and there, but yeah.
Yeah. It's pretty amazing. Now, so do you sell saxophones in your store?
So my store is really just online. I don't have a physical space yet. I've thought about it, but it's a pretty hard market, especially out here in Utah.
It's a hard market even here in the New York metropolitan area. A lot of those music stores are closing up shop and downsizing and just going online. So I feel you.
Yeah. So I mean, I do sell, like, if I get in saxophones, a lot of them are like on, I want to say commission, but that's maybe not the right word. But people reach out to me with stuff that they have to sell, and I just kind of help, you know, broker it a little bit, help find someone who's looking for it.
Oh, that's good. Go ahead.
I was going to say, and people come to me all the time saying, like, hey, do you know where I can get, like, you know, this horn or that horn? And, you know, I know a lot of people, so I try and help them out that way.
Nice. Well, I've got this Borgani silver plated alto that one day I will let go of. So maybe we can join efforts on getting the word out.
I'll put it, let me write it down. You said original silver, right?
Yeah. It's probably from 2005, maybe 2005, 2006. It's a nice horn. It's a nice horn.
Yeah. But somewhere now they're looking for it.
Maybe I'll do a little demo on my YouTube channel.
Awesome.
So you're in Salt Lake City, right?
Yeah. A little suburb of it called Sandy, but yeah, Salt Lake.
And how's the jazz scene out there?
It's pretty cool. I'll give a few experiences to help you kind of get a feel for it. So when I was in New York, I went and saw a couple jazz clubs with like some of the top musicians. And I won't say who, but at both of these gigs that I went to, there were about three people in the audience. And the waiter comped my food and my cover for being there, which I think was pretty cool. But I'm like, wait a second, this is the middle of New York with these great players and no one's here. And then I'm out here in the scene in Utah, and there's like a jam every day. Tons of people are coming. There's a lot of support for students and stuff like that. So it's different. Like the focus is different in a lot of places. I think it's really dense here in like the post-college scene. That's what I might say.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. You know, New York has the largest community, but at the same time, that could be a detriment because it's spread out and everybody's kind of doing their own thing. And it's large enough that not everybody knows each other, whereas, as you know, in a smaller community, there might be more of that camaraderie that you might find. Even out here in Jersey City, where I am, there's like a little scene here that's, it feels tight knit. I mean, you know, don't get me wrong. There's definitely, there's a lot of people working together in New York to make a good scene there. And there is a good scene, but I think it can get a little bit spread out and you lose some of that hominess that you're getting at.
Yeah, I agree.
So are you getting out there and playing much?
So my Instagram is mostly saxophone, but a lot of my gigs are on all of the doubles that I do. Because I studied clarinet, bassoon, and flute as well in college. Last night I did a soprano recorder gig out on Temple Square, which is like a big church site. And, you know, at Christmas time, they have lots of concerts there. And on the 27th, I'm doing Cirque music, which I think is related to Cirque du Soleil. But that, I may be wrong on that, but that's with bassoon and Barry. I've done some pits that are, flutes, clarinets, and saxes and stuff. So, but I try and get out to the jams as much as I can. Bourbon House is one of my favorite ones. It's really low key and fun to film too.
Cool. Are you making time every day to practice all those doubles?
Right now it's kind of in maintenance mode. I did a lot of studying throughout college, but and so I asked my professors what to do about it, and they are some just a little insight. My main professor, Ray Smith, he got his woodwind degree on all five from Indiana University. I think that's where he got his doctorate. And so he's been one of the main recording session players around here. And so they'll call him for everything. And then the adjunct professor, Darren Bradford, is also that same way. If you looked him up on YouTube, he did like the world record concerto or something with like 30 different woodwinds in one piece. Jeez. But anyway, and what they told me is you kind of try and focus on building one at a time while maintaining the others. Because you do have to, your musicality will basically sit on the highest instrument that you have. And so you have to always be working on your musicality and then keeping your technique up on whichever other one you're working on.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, I used to play a lot of doubles for big band when I was in school. But once I got out of school, I was just using it for, you know, teaching occasional lessons. And then in the last few years, I really haven't been touching my clarinet or flute at all. But it's a scary thought to try to jump back in on those, just because they really require, you know, even to just get to that maintenance level, it requires a ton of work to not sound awful, especially on the clarinet. It's just like the most unforgiving thing ever.
Well, there's a lot of exercises they taught me that were specific to someone. Even though I started on clarinet, they taught me these things too. Like if you're switching from clarinet to sax or saxophone to flute or so on and so forth, there's all these exercises you can do to help differentiate what's going on in your mouth, because that's probably like the biggest thing you have to be able to adjust. And so I'm working on coming out with some videos that will, you know, talk about what exercises I do to get my chops back up on clarinet. And surprisingly, for like my clarinet students who've switched over from guys who used to, like they had teachers that were playing in the symphony and they would come over to me. They didn't teach these exercises, and they're like, whoa, these are like really cool. You know, like why, you know, anyway,
I'm intrigued. I'm looking forward to seeing these videos. So are you going to put these on your YouTube channel that you have up now?
Yeah. And that'll probably come a few videos down the road, but yeah, it's in the works. So
what have you been doing on YouTube lately? Cause you started mostly with Instagram, right? With a lot of, you know, pictures and a couple of videos, I think now and again, but you started the YouTube channel pretty recently.
Yeah. So I just started up to, you know, get some more long form content. You know, Instagram has limited space. So, and YouTube, I can talk more in depth about the horns that I have and that I'm trying. I can talk more about, you know, different gear and new things that are out on the scene. And that's something that I really like to do is, you know, see what's out there, see what's new, and present that to everyone. So like
what,
the last couple
what is out there. What are the you know, if we're just talking about saxophone for a second here, what are the must have gear items for 2019?
Oh, the must have. Okay. Well, I mean, if you don't have key leaves by now, you got to have key leaves.
Well, I have them thanks to you.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. Yeah. Anyway,
why don't you tell everybody what key leaves are, just for so everybody knows.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess I have them here. So for those that can't see them, they're these green. Think of like a Lance Armstrong band, except green and not related to Lance Armstrong. And you have these two little props on the end. And basically what you do is you throw it in the under the E flat and C sharp arm on your saxophone. And it holds open those two and the G sharp key. And those are like the stickiest ones on the saxophone.
Yeah.
And so like, I was one of their beta testers maybe 2 years ago. It's that I've been using them. And I did like a week with, what was it? A couple months, a month, something. I did some amount of time with them and without them. And ever since I've kept them back on, and it's like, you know, they work. So it's like I say it's like brushing your teeth. You know, if you're not doing it already, you should be.
It's a lot easier than brushing your teeth because you just pop them in under your keys. And, it really is just a way to keep those keys that are usually closed when the saxophone is resting, just keeping them open so that the air can circulate, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And then they aren't like closing with the contact of the leather to the metal with the moisture and all kinds of things that happen when that happens.
Yeah. All right. So key leaves definitely on the list. Anything else come to mind? Mouthpieces, ligatures, fancy looking end caps.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's maybe not something that I can recommend to everybody. But I know that the SIOS have certainly become trending this year, especially compared to last year. They're blowing up, which is really awesome.
That's a mouthpiece.
Yeah. So those were actually the first two YouTube videos I did were on those SIOS mouthpieces. I mean, you can see how bright this one is.
Yeah, this ridiculous. is a Ninja Turtle green tenor mouthpiece that Derek is holding up here. Really, as green as you can imagine.
Yeah, it's wild. But yeah, so there's some, you know, pretty popular artists that are using them and endorsing them. So I asked them recently for like a list of how they compare to vintage mouthpieces, you know, because I'm always trying to draw some parallel there.
Yeah.
And their whole thing is that they really aren't imitating vintage mouthpieces. It's kind of their own thing. And so they just sent me out a bunch to try. And so that's what my first couple of videos on YouTube were. We're like unboxing 9 of these SIOS mouthpieces. And, you know, and then trying the two most popular, which were the Chad LB and the Ryan Devlin.
Cool. I haven't tried these mouthpieces before, but it sounds interesting. They look interesting, that's for sure.
Yeah, they are 3D printed. I think it's from ABS Plastic, if I'm not mistaken. And they're not hand-faced, so it's just straight off the machine. And so there are pros and cons to that with the different materials, but the main thing that they really market is that it's the same mouthpiece that the professionals are playing because they can just machine it just like that.
And how much do they cost approximately?
So the you can get a custom one, and I ended up getting 2 custom ones, and that's a little under $300. It's like the 260, 270 range, something like that. And the signature ones, which are the ones that the artists play, and then you can, you know, switch up the tip opening. Those ones are in the like 180, 190 range, US dollars.
Gotcha. Very cool. Yeah, I have to get around to messing around. I haven't played a mouthpiece other than my usual mouthpiece in a really long time. So I'd be interested to see what else is out there.
Yeah. So what are you playing on right now?
I've been playing on a Pillinger for at least 10 years. That's what I play on alto. It's kind of like a Meyer. It's kind of like a New York Minor type of a thing.
Right.
But I like it a lot. And, you know, every time I switch to a different mouthpiece, I generally sound the same. And I think it really, you know, going into that whole conversation about gear and if it matters or not, or how much it matters, you know, especially with saxophone, you know, my take on it is you're going to sound how you're going to sound pretty much regardless of how the gear is. Cause I've switched mouthpieces a bunch of times and I pretty much sound like me. But what changes is how easily that sound comes, like how much resistance I have to fight through. Sometimes I like having a little bit of resistance, especially when it comes to reeds and mouthpieces. Like a totally free blowing horn is not always what I want because it's nice to be able to lean into something a little bit. It's kind of like if you're swinging a baseball bat, if the bat is like a wiffle ball bat, you're not going to be able to hit a real baseball. So you need to have a heavier bat to really be able to, like I said, lean into that note or whatever it is you're playing.
Right.
So I forgot what I was talking about. If gear matters, to me, it has to do with how much you're having to fight against it. Like some gear is just going to set you up for success and make it easier to get the end result. But that's only if, I don't know, how do I put this? It's like, that's only if you're able to, like you're going to sound, I don't know how to explain this, Derek, help me out here. Do you know what I'm getting at?
Yeah. Yeah. I know what you're saying. There's like this baseline that you need to hit. And then above that baseline, things stop mattering.
Right.
And you get that
diminishing returns.
Yeah. So I mean, it's kind of like in the professional world, like once you reach a certain point, people can hire you and they'll feel comfortable hiring you and you can do just fine. And, you know, you could be amazing or you could not be, but, if you're above that level, then it's really about, you know, if you're there and available and you have, you know, the knowledge. But then as you get higher, then you can get into the stuff that really, you know, it becomes artistic. So there's like this there's like three different sections I like to think of. The bottom one is like stuff that doesn't really work. So going back to mouthpieces, the bottom stuff is like beginner mouthpieces or, you know, stuff marketed to beginners that's not really working. And beginners are going to be fighting that a lot, and it's going to be causing, you know, lots of stress. There's like this middle ground where it's like really acceptable and you can, you know, play everything you need to at a professional level in there. And then there's like this third level, which is like when your own personal artistry and your ears change, you go into that third level, basically just to calm yourself down and to, you know, because you're neurotic and trying to, you know, make things work for you. I don't know if that makes sense, but.
Yeah, it does. I mean, it's like if we make it really practical here, and you give, if you, I mean, let's take it away from saxophones and use an analogy. Like if you put like a regular person in a race car, they're going to drive it how they're going to drive it. They're not going to be able to really utilize the potential of that race car. And if they try to, there's a good chance they could just, you know, spin out and crash the car. Versus, let's just keep it down to two categories here. You know, you put a professional race car driver in that race car, and they're going to really max out on it. They're going to be able to squeeze all the juice out of it. I'm doing an analogy of an analogy now. And I think that's how it goes for gear. It's like, yeah, if you give a beginner a Mark VI, they're going to sound pretty much the same way they're going to sound as if they had, you know, like a student, like a Yamaha student model or something. But then of course, if you give those two horns to, you know, like a Chris Potter or somebody, you know, maybe you're going to hear, you know, he's going to probably make both horns sound great, but you might hear a little bit of a difference then. And yeah, he'll be able to tell you that he can tell there's a difference. That's the real thing. It's like, is the student who's starting out going to be able to tell that there's a difference between that student Yamaha model and the, you know, the Mint Mark VI? Probably not, just because they don't have the experience to make use of that differential. So,
yeah, exactly. There's like this level of priorities that need to be addressed. Like, yeah, that student won't be able to tell what's going on, so they really need to focus on their performance. And then when you're in that upper level, like your gear needs to match your performance. That makes sense. So there's kind of like that flip.
Yeah, so, for sure. But there's one other thing I think about when I ruminate on these matters, and that is that getting a new piece of gear, even if it doesn't make a difference with your actual playing, sometimes it can be so exciting to have something new that you're just encouraged to practice all the time. You know, there's that novelty factor. And
oh,
as silly as it is to say, I can attest from my own experience, like when I got my first non-rental saxophone, like my first purchased saxophone, it wasn't anything special, but you know, every time I've sort of upgraded to a better piece of equipment, it gives me an extra burst of motivation to shed like as much as possible, just because it's exciting to get on that new piece of gear.
Oh, absolutely. And I think sometimes as musicians and as artists, we try to be too objective, but really we're probably some of the most subjective people, you know, out there in terms of our career. So yeah, like when you're looking at gear, it needs to work and it needs to, you know, be able to play and meet all that, the audio stuff, but at the same time, you know, make sure it looks good and make sure, you know, it's something that you want to play and you don't want to fight. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I mean, it's the same with music. It's like you got to practice the stuff that's going to make you better. But at the end of the day, you know, you want to play music that makes you happy. And if you're playing, you know, if let's make it as simple as playing alto versus tenor. Like if you've been playing alto all your life and all you've ever wanted to do is play tenor, you know, at a certain point you can switch to tenor and it's not going to, it's okay. It's okay to make that switch. You know, if you want to be playing a metal mouthpiece and try that out, and if you've always liked that sound, then switch to the metal mouthpiece. But don't fall into the trap of thinking you need to buy a new piece of gear every day of the week to keep yourself motivated, or because you think it's going to be like the answer to your problems. You know, every once in a while it might be the answer to your problems, but most of the time, if you, you know, I tell my students this and I tell myself this, like most of the time, if you just practice a little bit more on what you have, you can probably get past that hurdle, whatever it may be. So it's a tough call because, you know, I can speak from experience that I've definitely bought gear and practiced more because of it. But sometimes I have to remind myself to put my credit card down and just practice.
Yeah. A lot of people come to me and ask, you know, should I buy this? Should I not? And I always, you know, ask them about their budget because that really is something important. You know, knowing their limits, because I think we'd probably buy everything if we could. And there are some people that are, you know, always looking to buy the next new mouthpiece, probably me included. You know, I'm probably guilty of this, but, yeah, if we, yeah, we can make the best out of, you know, what we have too. But maybe if I were to give some practical advice, there's a few things that do need to happen, and things that you do need to worry about gear wise, especially as a saxophone player. And this is probably for beginners. The number one thing that's going to plague a beginner is like a warped reed or a mouthpiece that isn't flat on the table, just because a lot of those mouthpieces are made cheap and the students can't tell as long as they get a sound out. But so if you get a mouthpiece with a flat table and your reed is happening, you'll grow a lot faster because then you're not fighting, you know, fighting the bad equipment and using your energy on that.
And then the table is like the area where the reed touches the mouthpiece. Yeah.
Yeah. So if we have our mouthpiece, it's just what the reed sits on top of.
Yeah.
And it's probably not the best to show it on the bright green mouthpiece, but, anyway. Yeah. And then the other thing, of advice is to make sure that the pads are sealing. No matter how good you are, if your saxophone isn't sealing, you're not going to be able to manipulate it in an artistic way. It's just going to fight you the whole time and it's going to frustrate you. And so, you know, you may want to quit some days if those two things aren't working out.
Right. It gets into that, like, if you're fighting against your equipment too much, it's going to just get so frustrating that it might demotivate you, from actually picking it up. I mean, practicing can be hard, but you don't want to have to hate it. And if you can at least make the gear work well for you and have it be in decent shape, it'll make practicing the hard stuff a little bit easier.
Yeah. And so, I mean, a personal story of that with me is when I was in college, I was playing on this refaced modern Autolink. And, you know, so it did have a flat table. It was happening pretty well. And I knew my horn was in solid repair, but I just couldn't get above like a mezzo forte. Like it was just a really quiet mouthpiece. And so I always thought it was me, you know, I wasn't using enough air. I wasn't pushing. And so I was always fighting that. And then I switched mouthpieces and it's like, all of that practice I had trying to fight that other mouthpiece. Now suddenly this other mouthpiece sounds great and it's free and I can, it responds a little bit easier. So I can, you know, practice a little differently. And it's like, man, I wish I'd gone back a few years and switched, you know, I could have learned, you know, many things. So it's like two sides of that coin. So, I mean, you got to be informed about what's out there and what's going on. So.
And what about reeds? You know, the Sios, did they call it Sios or is that?
That's what I say. That's what I hear the most. All right, so.
Well, we'll call it Sios for now. The bright green mouthpieces, besides mouthpieces, what are your reeds? What reeds are you enjoying this year?
So there's a couple different brands. I'm not stuck on one. I'm always switching, but right now, I'm on the Boston Sax Shop reeds and these ones they're pretty flexible. I use the same reed, which was the first one out of the box. I didn't even try any of the others on my first Sios video, and it worked on all 12 mouthpieces that I tried. And so there's something about how it has like a slightly thicker tip. I'm working on being able to measure all these, but that one is pretty sweet. I do like the Rugati cut reeds. So there's like Rugati Gold, Roberto's Winds, and I think Lupafaro as well. They're really similar. They all have a slightly different cut, but it's from that same factory. And I think those reeds are pretty flexible.
Nice. Yeah, I'm definitely ready to start playing around with some other reeds as well. I've been using hemp keys forever.
Okay.
And yeah, it's getting to the point where I'm just kind of curious what else is out there.
Yeah. If you are trying new reeds, there's the break-in process, I would probably say, is the biggest thing so that you don't get a bad impression of the new brands. And because it's really dry out here in Utah, it's if you leave a reed out, it's going to warp super fast. I don't think it's pretty humid in New York, right? New Jersey.
Well, this time of year, it's definitely drier, especially with the heat on all the time. Okay. Are you if a reed warps, are you tossing it or are you going to try to play it out?
No, I just use the reed geek and flatten it out. So that's kind of what I do. Geek.
I think I know what that is.
Yeah. I have one right here. It's the
rectangular prism. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like a black piece. I don't know if it's carbide. It's something really hard like that. And you just have these four really straight edges and just scrape off. It works with a scraping motion instead of a cutting motion.
You got some neat tools over there, Derek. I'm gonna have to go shopping at the Sac Spy shop.
Yeah, I'll help you out. But as far as the reed breaking process, I just wanted to talk about that a little bit because it's one that's taken forever. It's one that Ron Fix showed me. It's basically, I don't want to reach for it, but it's like a cell phone container. It's like a waterproof cell phone container. You get two of them for like $15. It's a lot cheaper than what's out there. And put the reeds in, fit maybe 10 or 12, and then like a sponge soaked in yellow Listerine, and then, you know, wrung out pretty much. And that just, you know, disinfects it, prevents the mold, but it keeps them like in this state of like, you know, saturation. You know, so when I pull them out to play, it's not going from dry to wet, dry to wet. And that extreme is what causes the warp. And so.
Does it have to be like yellow Listerine?
The yellow is the one without sugar and without some other additives. And so that's what I've been recommended. But technically, they call this the wet reed approach. Some guys use tequila or vodka. So
I think I used to do this. I don't think I used yellow. I used regular green Listerine for a little bit. I think I did the vodka trick for a little bit. And, one day my reeds just were covered in mold. So
yeah.
I think I just needed to change it out a few times.
Yeah, I just change it out weekly and I haven't had any problems. So
yeah, it's a lot of maintenance to play the saxophone, but you know, it's a good instrument. So
it's
worth the efforts. So in regards to playing, you are you're doing some doubling, you're going out to the sessions now and again. Are you studying? Are you taking lessons still? Are you working with anybody?
So I'm not taking lessons currently. I studied with Chad LB for about 3 years, and then he closed down his private studio. And so since then, I've just been doing a lot of his books and, you know, working through some other ones. One of the new ones that I have, too, that's really cool is Tim Lin's book. I don't know if you know Tim Lin. He's in California.
The Modern Improviser. You know, I don't know if I've seen this one now.
Yeah, Melodic Shapes for the Modern Improviser. And basically, Tim's like a super studied guy. I'm pretty sure he's worked with like Bob Shepard and some other guys out there. But he's going to be a big player out there on the scene. But this book is, this one's all 2/5s in 2 and 4 bar phrases in minor and major, and then some diminished shapes. And so it's like probably the first type of vocabulary that, you know, someone should ever study. And so those are the kind of books that I'm trying to work on right now in lieu of like a private teacher.
Gotcha. Very cool. Yeah. That's, there's some really great books out there. I haven't checked any books out recently, but I remember when I was I'm trying to think of this one. The Charlie Parker Omnibook, you know, that one.
Yeah. That's if you want to learn how to sight read, that one will get you up to speed.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's also just going to give you like the backbone of bebop vocabulary. But actually, regarding sight reading, I found that once you kind of get the hang of that vocabulary, the sight read, it's not that hard to sight read anymore because there's a lot of repetition. But at the same time, it just goes to show like even the greats like Charlie Parker, I mean, there's a lot of recycled material in there. So, you know, people think that there's so much to learn to be able to be a jazz player. And there is, but, you know, at a certain point, you can kind of take what you know and just shed it as hard as you can and just get really good at something versus trying to be like kind of okay at everything. It's just one of the issues, you know, both with gear and with studying music. It's like there's so much out there nowadays that it's easy to get lost and focusing on one thing or on one piece of gear or on one type of approach to improvisation, I think it's really helpful.
Yeah. I mean, that's like what we talked about at the beginning with doubles. Like with anything, if you have all these different things that you can do, you can either focus on one and go deeper, or you can, you know, spread out and diversify. And so it's like two different approaches. You can't do both at the same time.
Yeah, that's true. These are wise words. Where can everybody check out your shop, your online store, and everything else?
So you can check out my website, saxspy.com. That's SAXSPY.com. Saxspy on Instagram and Saxspy Shop on Instagram as well for the shop page. And you can check out my YouTube channel. It's just youtube.com/C/Saxspy with two capital S's.
Cool. And so I'm clear, on your store, you're selling everything from what's included in the what's in the shop these days?
Yeah, so there's some really cool things. I try and stock everything that I personally like, and a lot of it is handmade or, you know, made here in house. And so, like, the smallest thing I sell are these, you know, awesome saxophone stickers of all these horns that I've taken pictures of, and horns that people have sent in to me, you know, and they wanted stickers, so we were able to make them. Something else are like my art prints that I make here in house. You see, this is like a Mark VI Alto with like a holographic design to it.
Yeah, those are nice.
So, and those are under $10. From there, I make, you know, the Saxspy end plugs. This one's the Galaxy. This is my own one.
I don't think anybody does. These are like the most unique things you can add to your saxophone. Yeah. It's really beautiful additions to that experience of playing.
Well, thank you.
That's great.
Yeah.
These, for everybody that can't see, these are the end plugs that you put in the top of your horn when you store your saxophone in the case.
Yeah. And so I make them to the custom measurements that people send in, so they fit your case well. And then every time you go to play, it's like you see like this really cool art piece. And to me, that inspires me. I mean, for those same reasons, I have, you know, a giant painting right here above my computer. I like to see it, and it inspires me, you know, to be more artistic. But yeah, some of the other things I have in the shop, I do carry the Key Leaves products. So I have the Key Leaves key props and the spit sponges, both for saxophone and for the woodwinds, because I know how tricky it is to have sticky keys on your clarinet and your flute. Mm-hmm. So those are pretty awesome. And I do sell like some used mouthpieces. I've got a couple original Florida Auto Links up there, a 6 and a 7. 7's pretty hard to find nowadays for Florida Auto Link. And yeah, whatever I can get up there. Sometimes people will, like my neighbor who sells all these saxophones, sometimes they'll give me something to put up for them, but it's all really cool stuff. So I'd go check it out.
Right. Well, everybody should definitely check out Derek's store, Saxspy Shop, on Instagram. And I'll have all the other links in the show notes. So I guess we'll leave it there for now, Derek. Thank you so much for making the time.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. And as always, everyone's free to reach out to me and ask me questions about their gear and whatnot. And maybe I'll help set you up with some different recommendations.
Sounds great. And whatnot. All right, Derek. See ya.
Cool. Take care.